This is part one of a two-part episode with Angie Jones of LexisNexis. We will have part two of our conversation with Angie in 2 weeks.
This show is sponsored by Qualitest. Deploy software that you and your customers trust with Qualitest testing and business assurance services. Learn more about Qualitest at qualitestgroup.com.
Hello and welcome to The Testing Show. I'm Michael Larson, your show producer, and today we'd like to welcome Percy Ababa.
Hello, everyone.
Matt Heuser.
Good morning, or good time zone you're in.
Sorry, I can't.
Jesse Costino.
Hey there.
And we'd like to welcome our special guest, Angie Jones. Angie, please introduce yourself.
Hi, everyone. I am a consultant automation engineer. I work over at LexisNexis in Raleigh, North Carolina, in the U.S. What I do is I consult with several teams there on providing an automation strategy. Not only that, but I'm also a practitioner. So I sit in with the teams and help them get going, build up automation frameworks, train their testers, educate the team on automation, that sort of thing.
Fantastic. All right. Well, then let's get started with our news segment. Matt, you got something to share?
So many things. I want to start with direct testing and move backwards a little bit. Spotify writing to your hard drive. Spotify is an app. It seemed to work fine. There seemed to be no significant problems. And yet it writes massive amounts of data to your hard drive. Very specifically, it's a large database file that seems to be mostly redundant data, and it can be 5 to 10 gigabytes of data in less than an hour, even when the app is running idle. Leaving it running for periods longer than the day can be up to 700 gigabytes. The reason this is a big issue is if you have an SSD hard drive and you fill it up, it can suddenly become slower. I guess the testing angle here is this is not in the requirements. It's not described anywhere. The software works fine, and yet there's this problem. And I don't think that's unusual. Our models of what we're testing, I think, need to expand. And also, how the heck did that happen?
I could sort of understand this if you are actively listening. It seems excessive to me, but then again, if you want to be able to buffer your stream and be able to have continuous playback, that it's annoying, certainly, but it doesn't seem completely out of the question, especially if you've got a steady stream going. But it also sounds to me like this is happening even when you're not playing. The app just being active is doing this. That seems like a big red flag, and how did somebody not catch that?
Well, even if you're streaming, it's streaming. Put it in memory. Buffer it. Why is it running to your hard drive that much? There are sort of client-y, server-y things which you want to cache or whatever, but peer-to-peer file sharing doesn't do that much right into your hard drive.
You know, I go to a lot of dev conferences as well as testing conferences, and this is something that's being promoted quite a bit lately in these conferences, is to write to the user's disk instead of trying to work from your server or whatever. I can see how they've gotten into this predicament. In those same sessions, I never hear anyone give the caveat of, oh, well, don't write too much data. You know what I mean? And so they're really encouraging developers to work this way for seamless operations and offline, online type of changes.
My guess is that somebody took that advice and wrote a code library, which had some extra junk in it they didn't care about, and Spotify included that code library, possibly open source, is my guess. Or there's just some kind of error in a for loop somewhere.
Yeah, it's one of those things as a tester, like you said, it's not mentioned in the recs. It's not something that we explicitly looking for, but as a tester, these are probably the types of considerations that we need to make and bring forward as information. I'm not sure if they did or didn't, but 700 gigs, I don't know if they've ever even gotten to the point where they were playing this for a full day. Who would think of that scenario? You know what I mean?
Yeah, who would? I guess in the old days, we would have the requirements and we would have the project plan and we would create our little equivalence classes and come up with all these ways to slice and dice the application. Most modern teams, involve the tester in the whole process of delivery. And there's a chance the tester could overhear, or it's probably through code review, right? Someone should be like, what's that about? Why? What is this file, Mercury.db? And why are you writing it there? And what do you need it for? You bingoed that for loop. It's going to happen forever, which is really, I think, what happened.
This is something that I've learned from Mark Tomlinson with regards to understanding the data states of your application. For example, if you're looking at five distinct sources that can affect performance by looking at where data is actually stored or how it's transferred. So you're looking at storage, for example, permanent storage, where that's where your disk drives are, or solid state disk drives. You should be able to look into temporary storage too, where memory or caching solutions, then you're looking at how your data is being manipulated, because that will definitely affect performance. Then you're going to see how data is being moved, and then also how data is being displayed. So you're pretty much looking at the whole gamut of performance. Seeing these things as part of the things that you need to be checking, I guess that's what Alan Page calls this, the illities. These are things that we could have caught. I mean, Spotify testers would have been able to catch these things. Going beneath the surface of what might affect your application, not just from a functional perspective, would be a really good checklist to have when it comes to having these client-server type applications on your desktop.
That's a really good point. And we're assuming that the Spotify testers didn't find this, and they could have very well have. From my understanding of that news story, even once Spotify was notified, it took them several months to address the issue. Maybe it just wasn't, they didn't know how to, or they had to come up with a new plan of delivering the content.
It's very possible that they found it and somebody said, well, this is kind of core to our architecture, so what are you going to do? And then once the bug became serious and became news, then they had to rethink it. And I think that's one of the most powerful things a tester can do. Prevent. What are you going to do? Ship it anyway. Oops.
The recorded amounts, the data that they're talking about being measured and that are being written, are in the terabytes. Even when Spotify is idle and it's not storing songs locally, when you're just streaming it, what are you keeping? Why would it require that? And the biggest challenge that we're referring to this is that they're literally talking about this taking years off of the life of your hard drive.
A question that I have, and I don't know if it's a legitimate question, because obviously I don't know their software architecture or their database architecture. I don't know how it's working and what they're using, but I always wonder about security when you're talking about going from anything that is stored somewhere else to something that is stored on my computer. And what does that mean? And what does that look like? And if somebody wanted to perform a malicious action and have it perpetuate very easily, it seems like a really good way to do it. I don't know, but that would be a concern I would have from a test perspective if I knew the architecture.
Moving on from the Spotify thing, and I hope more information comes out. If we figure out what the deal is, we'll let it be known. Uber has a self-driving car problem in bike lanes as safety concerns mount. Meanwhile, Google is talking about releasing its self-driving cars. If this works, it's going to put a whole lot of taxi cabs out of work. Until it works, it's pretty darn dangerous.
Well, one example we can talk to right now, sharing something from The Verge from the 14th of December, Uber's fleet of self-driving cars began to pick up passengers in San Francisco for the first time. One of their vehicles was caught running a red light.
The number of independent variables that that computer would have to track in order to actually drive, and the amount of technological programming, I mean, honestly, you'd have to write it in a functional language like Clojure or Lisp or something, and then actually having humans code review it and understand what it's really doing and testing it would be incredibly hard. It's almost like the first airplane pilots. A lot of them died. A lot. Until we figured out how the heck to do it. And that was with mechanical controls.
I saw something a bit earlier. I think it might have been The Verge as well. But it was about these same Uber self-driving vehicles and how they're unsafe for bicyclists. And so there were a couple of incidents, and I believe Uber admitted this themselves, that they've observed them making turns into the cycling lane. So if there were cyclists in that lane, they would have been hit.
I just did a little bit of searching, and at least on this particular article, they do have an update that was posted. It says Uber appears to have completed its review and concluded that it was the human driver, not the computer, that was at fault. These incidents were due to human error, a spokesperson said. This is why we believe so much in making the road safer by building self-driving Ubers.
What? Well, yeah, of course Uber's going to say that, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's very convenient,
if you look at,
right?
If you look at Uber's public statement when the state of California said, you can't do this, it's against the law, their response was kind of like, we have an obligation to do it because it's the right thing. The ultimate libertarian, screw you sort of comment. They've had some success with that as a strategy. They go into a place where they're like, nope, you need to have a taxi medallion. And they're, we're going to ignore you. And the people love it so much that they vote a resolution to change the law.
One thing that was in the article here is that the California DMV did rebuke Uber because they did not get a permit for autonomous vehicle testing. Because its car requires a human driver at all times, they aren't covered under the state's permitting guidelines.
Yeah, right. And they don't care.
I'm not laughing because it's funny. I'm laughing because of just the hubris of it.
So if it was me, I would find some unincorporated nothing in Nevada with like a house and a post, used to be a post office. Reincorporate it, make some local law, probably New Hampshire maybe, someplace. It's got a lot of independent people. Put big gates up and say, this is our field testing area and you can live here if you want and you might die. But if you don't, you're going to be testing the world's first autonomous vehicles in a beta-like environment. I think that's what they need next is a public beta test that you know about. The freeway doesn't go through here. There are posted signs. If you get on your bicycle and you go on the bike path, that's on you. Some people would. I think that's the level of quality of these products.
Images of Running Man and Death Race 2000 are going through my head right now.
You know, unless that happens, I don't see how or what's going to happen in California. It's also interesting because humans make mistakes too. Humans die. Humans forget. Humans turn the wrong way on a one-way street.
Well, you know, Uber supposedly found a legal loophole within San Francisco that allowed them to run these tests. Essentially, there's a legal definition of what an autonomous vehicle is, and Uber's car doesn't fall under that definition, which allowed them to quote-unquote legally run these within San Francisco itself. It might be a little bit of a stretch, but that seems to be what pushed them to run these things. On a different note, wouldn't it be really nice if we had like a red light oracle somewhere that these cars can all pull information out of so that they actually know when and when not to go?
Like, you put your red lights on the grid and you put wireless on the car and the car can hit an API and say, yep, it's a green light, I can go now.
Right. The cars can kind of also talk to each other. I think this is the concept between whether it's Android beacons or iBeacons. That's been out for a couple of years now, but for some reason, it's just been very difficult to scale up. It might be a very naive suggestion, but the technology is definitely out there.
I actually did beacon testing for a while, for probably about 9 months at one of the startups where I worked. And it's an interesting technology, but it definitely needs work. It's been probably 2 years since I've worked with it, but in terms of the beacons themselves and what they can do, and then, of course, the applications and the geofencing and all the stuff around communicating with the beacons, like, it's still really in its infancy. It'll be interesting to see how they choose to improve that, and I'd be curious if we could talk to those people who are testing it now.
It might be worth trying to reach out to them. Their language and strategies might be so wildly different than the way we think, but maybe we can learn from each other. Let's talk about Angie. So, Angie Jones, I hear about you on the Twitters. I read about you at conferences. I think we went to Test Bash, but didn't really get to talk or something. But,
were you at Test Bash Philly?
No, New York.
Oh, okay.
So I was at Test Bash Philly, and I did get the chance to shake Angie's hand there. So I don't know if she remembers me, though, because there were so many people.
Yeah, I do remember.
You gave a talk at Test Bash, right?
I did. I spoke on in-sprint automation. The title of the talk was How to Get Automation Included in Your Definition of Done.
I wasn't at Test Bash Philly, but Angie, I've seen two of your talks now, two of the titles, and I'm so curious. And having worked in a very similar space, I'm really interested to hear the methods that you are using to do that. I'm just so excited to hear you share that with us.
Yeah, yes. I did that talk at Test Bash Philly, and then straight from Philly, I flew out to London for the Selenium conference and did the talk there.
They have it on YouTube, so folks can check it out there. But I basically gave three techniques that people can use, very practical techniques that people were able to walk away with and they can apply right there on their day jobs on Monday morning. So I talked about being strategic in how you automate. And so I looked at Mike Cohn's testing pyramid, the automation pyramid, and talked about how when we're presented with things that we need to automate, how easy it is to kind of stay in that UI zone. I talked about ways that you can make hybrid tests that might expand a couple of those zones so that everything isn't so UI heavy. So that's one way to kind of move quicker and have your tests faster and less brittle, which is important in an agile environment. I also talked about communication. Our automation engineers in a lot of places that I've worked in the past have been kind of isolated and working in a silo and they're their own team and they're not involved in this whole agile transformation that companies have taken on. I talked about how to embed the automation engineer in those agile teams and what does that look like? What considerations need to be made and how can they work with the different team members to get what they need from an automation perspective, as well as inform and educate the team members on automation practices. The third part I talked about was to automate incrementally, taking on kind of the same agile staging that's done with development and doing that in automation. So using concepts like TDD and programming by intention within automation practices to ensure that you're not taking on too much within the sprint and you're coding what's necessary to get by.
My experience with successful tooling, usually we come up with the things that will be automated before the story kickoff, I guess is the right term. For each story, each isolated incremental unit of work. Then it goes into test, and then as a tester, I do all the testing, and we also do the tooling, and then we can call the story done. I've had some success with that. It sounds like you're talking about something a little bit different, and I wonder if you can go into a little more depth in how what you're recommending or suggesting is different than that.
Having the automation engineers embedded, my argument is that they hear a lot of what's going on and they can make better decisions about what it is that we're going to automate. I'm not an advocate of the automate all the things type of strategy. So I spoke against that, especially when you need to automate in sprint. I spoke about automating what's important and the way you would determine that is by being embedded in these teams and communicating with the different players, such as the business analysts, the testers, and the developers, and gathering information as a tester to figure out what should be automated, what are the risky areas that we should automate, and then planning that into the sprint cycle.
Yeah, I found that to be one of the more challenging aspects. Our company is a relatively small group. You know, our development team is all of 8 developers, and we have 4 testers, one of which is a fully 100% dedicated automation engineer. It does seem like it's always a game of catch up. What are the suggestions you would have for a team like mine? What can we do? We jump in and kind of help take on some of that extra busy work so that that automation tester can move forward. I hope I'm making sense.
Yeah, perfect sense. There's a lot that goes on in an automation engineer's role besides just scripting tests. Things like maintaining the code. So I always say that automation code is living, breathing code that we need to update and maintain just as we would production code. That's something that people don't necessarily calculate in their measurements when they're trying to estimate how long it's going to take to do the automation of this new work. Again, having the automation engineers embedded, they can hear the types of changes that are coming down the pipeline and prepare for that. Oh, well, I know that I'm going to have to update all of these scripts that we have. So let's build in some time for maintenance. I suggest that automation engineers delegate some of these extra things out. So they can handle the in-sprint automation, but there are some other things that other people can handle. If you're a developer and you're changing the features,
that will now break these tests, why can't that be your responsibility as the developer to go back and update those tests? Of course, put your automation folks on your code reviews and everything so that we make sure you didn't just screw stuff up and just make the test pass just to pass. That's something that the developer can own, especially if you're working in a continuous integration build or something where you see these tests fail. I encourage developers to own that piece of first looking at why the tests are failing. Let's assume the reason is because there's been a code change and not because the tests are fragile or not working correctly. The other piece of that is the monitoring of builds that may not be continuous integration, like maybe they run a couple of times a day or something like that, not on every check-in. This is something that I encourage testers to get involved with as we are shifting left and encouraging them to be more technical and get involved with automation. So it's not just about coding and scripting. They can do things like triage failures that come from automation runs, learning how to become comfortable with these automation reports, reading the code and figuring out what went wrong and opening a bug if need be, and then maybe even updating the code if they feel comfortable enough to do so.
How do you decide what tests to automate and how do you track the work? So some of the companies that I've worked with actually have automation tasks. Some of that is often just the automator looks at the story and comes up with some stuff. Other ones actually have a separate, and I don't like this, but they have a separate automation group or person, and then the tester comes up with the test cases, which have to be documented so the automator can automate them. I really don't like that for lots of reasons. It causes a lot of waste and duplication. In your world, Angie, how do you decide what's going to be automated? How do you track it so it's not done until the automation runs?
So the latter used to be my world. That was what I saw a lot with the isolated automation teams. In my talk, I speak about getting away from that type of mindset for all the reasons that you mentioned. Now doing a more agile, friendly approach to automation engineering. Part of that whole communication part that I speak of talks to how do you decide on what to automate? That's a very popular question that I get a lot. It's working with the people on the teams. You being embedded in the team, you're going to hear a lot of information that you didn't necessarily have when you were isolated outside of the team. That goes into your decision on how do you choose which ones to automate. Other areas like working with your business analyst, asking them the questions like, how are our customers using this? It's not uncommon for me to ask the business analyst to pull me some analytics about what's being used and how it's being used. Then I'm able to make better, wiser decisions based on that. If we don't have a lot of traffic in a certain area, I'm not going to write a whole bunch of automated tests around that because that's just more stuff that I have to maintain. And it's going to make our continuous integration builds longer with feedback that's not necessarily crucial to check-ins. Focusing on the risk areas is my first piece of advice. You get that, again, from the business analyst, but you can also get it from your testers. So as they're exploring the application, they know a lot about what areas are problematic. They can give you some insights on that. And then the developers as well. So you listen for things in these stand-ups where they're saying, I have to go in and mess with this part of the code that's like spaghetti and I hate going in that area of code. That's a red flag to me. Like maybe we need some additional automated testing around that area if it's that fragile.
The ones that I've seen with regards to the challenges when introducing automation to any team, and if you're introducing automation for the first time, you can actually see cultural shift kind of change within the team. There's a lot of complication that you have to deal with when it comes to introducing automation, even when looking into which ones we should be able to automate first and which tests we can rely on, what automation oracles do we have that we can use and reuse. But I think at the end of it all, it's really how the team kind of processes information. From what we've seen, I've been in teams where we had a really strong independent automation team that just focuses on regression, also looking into Where in the application can we judiciously use technology to solve some of these, whether it's a testing problem or whether it's a testability problem? The challenge really is, if not everybody is kind of on board, if not everybody understands the ramifications of a failure and whether we can debug that failure really fast, things will start falling behind. So having these small introductions on how can we deal with this particular problem, and as we go through the product coverage outline, where we can just identify this one we can automate because we understand this. This one we can't because it's just a complete black box for us. So having that deeper understanding and how we can actually react to a failure is then very key. For me personally, I see a lot of teams fail when it comes to automation because it's looked at as if, hey, we're just replacing humans executing these things. And then there is no response when something fails. It just remains a failure. I really like how Angie framed this. You remember in her test bash talk, the developer also needs to take ownership. If it's a testability feature that breaks because the developer introduced something, there has to be some sort of a shallow check or just something that can easily get triggered the moment a developer pushes code for a pull request, for example, that can then validate that change and say, oh, you actually broke this appointment creation API and now 60% of our tests will fail because we can't create any new appointments. It's this type of feedback that we can give to the developers in having really some sort of a one-to-many or one-is-to-one relationship and showing that because you broke this piece, we're blocked in these areas on what we can test or what we can check. And then, of course, the developers will have to respond and fixing that before we even merge that into master or push that into a different branch for building within your CI pipeline.
This is the end of part one. Come back and join us for part two of our conversation with Angie Jones in 2 weeks.
Thank you for listening to The Testing Show, sponsored by Qualitest. For more information, please see www.qualitestgroup.com. Do you have questions? Or is there a topic or an idea you'd like to have covered? Please email us at thetestingshow@qualitestgroup.com and we will answer questions we receive on air.